good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the latest in the Director's Dialogues. And for those who haven't attended before, the rules of this particular game are that I hold a conversation for a while with our guest, but then at a certain point I will throw it open to the audience for them to question and comment. Now, many of you will know Bill Morris very well, and indeed I thought I knew Bill Morris quite well until I started digging around into his CV and into his past. And I discovered to my surprise that he was born in Bombay and educated in Manchester. However, I should emphasize this is Bombay, Jamaica, and Manchester, Jamaica. So he is as he appears. And until 16, he lived in Jamaica. And so it says in the files, his early ambition was to play cricket for the West Indies. But he then came to the UK in 1954, and began to work for Hardy Spicer, parts manufacturer in the Midlands, now in fact part of GKN, or perhaps it wasn't at the time, I don't know, perhaps it was. Quickly, however, became a shop steward at the age of 34, and then 10 years later went full-time in the TNG and moved up the ranks of the transport and general workers, and no doubt that's a complicated process, until the election in 1991 for the General Secretary when Bill succeeded. And he then spent 12 years at the top of that slippery pole as General Secretary of the TNG. That was not his only contribution to British public life during that time. Of course, he sat for many years on the TUC General Council. He was on the Commission for Racial Equality, on ACAS, on the BBC's Advisory Board. Indeed, for the last few years, has been a director of the Bank of England, where we sat together on a board for a few years. And he then retired from the TNG in October of last year, saying memorably that he was now moving from who's who to who the hell is he. But of course, his public life is not over, and one appointment that he has carried forward has been that Bill is Chancellor of the University of Technology in Jamaica, with an 18-hectare campus in Kingston and some botanical gardens, rather like the LSE, really. And in fact, if anyone wants to look, there's an extremely fetching photograph of you in a special hat on the website. Now, Bill says he's going to spend more time on that, but we knew that another important job was imminent when he said that he planned to spend more time with his family and his grandchildren, because that is always a clue that a new job is on the way. And he is now leading an inquiry into employment practices in the Metropolitan Police, and we'll come on to that, I'm sure, in a little while. But let me start with a really difficult question, Bill. Do you think that now, given the performance in South Africa, it could actually be your moment to play for the West Indies?
Well, it's certainly my moment to watch the West Indies, because I'm going out next Friday to do just precisely that. I shall, of course, visit the campus and just to make sure that, you know, the Office of the Chancellor is still something that exists. It hasn't been abolished. But now I'm looking forward to that, and we will certainly. I've been in touch with Jonathan Agnew, so I'll probably have a few words to send greetings back home here.
Well, if I were you, I'd take your wife. You might be needed at some point. But then coming back to when you came over to this country and then got a job in the Midlands where your mother came, why then did you move into trade unionism and away from working in the parts plant?
Well, can I first of all say that I've never planned a career, and I've never worried about the next task or the next job. It happens or it doesn't happen, and for me, I've had the good fortune that it has happened. But I joined Hardy Spices. I've just missed the apprenticeship, because the intake was at the age of 15, school leaving age, those days was about 14. But the company was extremely good. They gave me the opportunity for Hansworth Tech, their release, and all that went with it. So my aspirations really was to work my way through a system and join the supervisory ranks. But everyone else was joining the trade unions, and there were three unions, and I felt that it was the thing to do, so I joined the TNG. And we had a major dispute for recognition, and I was like the gopher, you know, I would go for this and go for that. I was quite intrigued about the way the unions were conducting the dispute, management's response. And ultimately, the dispute was settled, and we all went back to work. And the representative in my department went off ill. So we had a deputation as to how we would make representation, because it wasn't sort of the done thing to go on your own. So we had a deputation. And we stood outside the supervisor's office, trying to decide who would actually make the case, make the arguments. And I found myself standing before the supervisor, and he had a reputation, and he said yes. He kept me waiting for what looked like about 5 minutes. It might have been 2 seconds, but it just felt like that. Anyway, we made our arguments, and I think we succeeded in getting what we wanted. And at the end of that period, my colleagues decided that we should have a representative, because the one who was our elected representative didn't want to continue. He was sick. And we decided to not elect one, but to have a rota. And I was deputed onto the rota as the first. And nobody has ever revisited the rota, so I think I'm still on the rota. And as they say, the rest is history. But no, I genuinely felt that I wanted to be an engineer, and I wanted to move into the ranks of supervision, and that was what I would have liked to have done, and not to have gone into the trade union movement.
What was the racial composition of the workforce? Were you mainly representing whites at that time?
Yes, of course, yes. It's as Britain is today. I reckon the composition of our workforce, and there were 3,000 people employed at Hardy Spices. It would have been about 7% there, 10% at the highest, of ethnic minority representation. But the overwhelming majority of the people who work in the plant was ordinary British, English, Scottish, Irish.
So you must have been pretty unusual at that time to be a shop steward, a black shop steward, in a predominantly white plant.
Yes, I think most of my trade union career have been first, because nobody else wants these jobs, so you have to be first. And so I was the first shop steward, I was the first senior steward, and the first black TNG delegate to the conference, and so it went on, and ultimately became the first black general secretary. So, as I said, nobody wanted these jobs.
Now, if you look at the profile of the Transport and General Workers Union over the last 30 years, and I guess it, being so large, it's a reasonable proxy for what's gone on in the trade union movement as a whole, that the membership was about 1.5 million, I think, when you became a full-time official or something like around there. Sure. And then it moved up to over 2 million in the late 70s, and is now about 900,000. Now, to what do you ascribe that rise and really quite dramatic fall? The thing fell by half over the last 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I think that the fact of the matter is that the trade union, the TNG's membership was orientated around the manufacturing sector, and around transport, and you know, we were very heavily orientated in steel, in road and commercial transport. And what we have actually seen is a decline in the areas that we were dominant, and where there has been growth in the economy, in the service sector, in the IT sector. We have not managed to recruit and build a membership. So dominant sectors were going down, new sectors was emerging, but we've not managed to make the transformation at all. 30% of British manufacturing has actually disappeared. The fact of the matter is that when I joined the trade union and worked in the sector, there were 7 million people in manufacturing. It's dropped below 4 million today, and we've not managed to make the transformation in recruiting in the new sectors of the economy.
But I mean, why have you not managed to make the transition? Because the employment issues are the same in different sectors. I mean, there's nothing uniquely manufacturing about the relationship between the employer and the employee.
No, but that's true in terms of some of the issues, but the profile of people in employment today has changed quite significantly. A lot of people are self-employed. A lot of people work part-time. A lot of people are fixed-term contract. And the whole concept of collective bargaining in the traditional way, a lot of people don't have a need for collective bargaining because of the structure by which their remuneration is determined. I still believe, nevertheless, that people at work have needs. They need support. They need, even if they are self-employed, that does not mean that the trade union movement can't provide a service for them, because we've got situation. One example, in one dairy company, the members who delivered milk, they stopped the doorstep delivery because the supermarkets became dominant and you get your milk there and all sorts of reasons. And what the company did, it decided to dispose of its fleet of milk delivery drivers. But what the company actually did, it gave, it provided a loan so that the delivery personnel could purchase these fleets. And on Friday, they were actually employees, and on Monday, they were self-employed. Now, the challenge that we had was, how do we continue to support a new group of workers? We couldn't throw them out of the union. We didn't want to anyway. And what we actually did was to go into the city and bought a package of support for them, which meant that they were made aware of their employer responsibility, like insurance, VAT, PAYE, accountancy, and we sort of got this package to give them support to make the transition. So it's those sort of new needs and new demands and new requirements that the trade union movement has got to focus its mind, because that's where the employment pattern is drifting to. And you have to follow the pattern and meet the new needs and meet the new demands, and that's what we have to do.
But I mean, to hear some people talk, it's as if trade unions are going to become sort of cooperative clubs like UPA or Consumers Association or the AA or something, you know, with services for members. I mean, do you see, I mean, that might caricature it slightly, but do you see that being the direction, and that the traditional role of representation and bargaining is condemned more or less to disappear?
No, I think there'll always be a role for representation, and you know, whether you represent people in the traditional workplace, represent them to the employer on a minute-by-minute or daily basis, or whether you represent them in a new working environment, it's still representation of sort. People will always have needs, and trade unions are well placed to give them that support. But different people want different things. The agenda has changed. The issues for which people now bargain are to some extent different. People want protection around health and safety issues. The whole concept of the work-life balance, these are new issues under the agenda. The environment are new issues under the agenda. And trade union has got to link into these new issues. There's a new agenda evolving to which we've got to link into if it is that we are going to maintain our relevance to workers. I think trade unions also needs to reorientate itself back into the community from whence it grew, because we have a set of circumstances where if trade unions are seen to be promoting social issues, seen to be campaigning on the issues of the day, whether it's about saving the hospitals or arguing that a pedestrian crossing should be outside the school for safety reasons or whatever, and get back to the community. It seems to me that if the community feels that trade unions are giving them support, then they will join trade unions and develop, and everybody will in fact benefit. But if the trade unions only see its role as a workplace role and not a role supporting within the communities, then as the workplace shrinks, trade union will shrink as well.
Yeah. But one of the curiosities about membership at the moment is that I think the figures are approximately sort of 30-32% of the workforce unionized, part-time only about 20%. And there's one slight puzzle in a way, because in some ways you might argue that part-timers are often, in a way, more exploited than full-timers, or more vulnerable to sometimes. And another paradox another curiosity, is the huge variations by region, in that you've got over 40% trade union membership in Northern Ireland, say, and only about 21% in the southeast. I mean, how do you explain this profile?
Well, it'd be easy to say that, take a defensive position and say, well, our density is probably still one of the highest in Europe or in Western and developed economy, but that's no real defense. The fact is that some of it is tradition and history. People who lived in certain parts of the country have this long tradition. The northern regions of our country has always had a higher density of trade unionism than the southern region. But I'll still come back to the absolute reality that we have to face, that we have an economy which is expanding, it's growing. New sectors are emerging, but we are not finding a message which resonates with the new workers. And that's what we have to find. We have to say what it is that people want at work today. Is it fundamentally different from what they wanted a decade or two or three decades ago? As the evolution develops, then the trade union movement has got to evolve with new thinking, new thoughts, and new ideas as to how they reconnect with workplaces and how they reconnect with communities.
Now, you mentioned the European dimension, and the conventional story, if you like, of the trade union relationship with the European Union is that initially, I think it's fair to say that many trade unions, perhaps most, were rather suspicious of the EU and tended to follow a sort of left of the Labour Party line. And then, so the caricature runs, you invited Jacques Delors to the TUC conference in 80, about some time, I can't remember exactly when. Charmed you all by talking about the social dialogue and the social chapter and this kind of thing. And then from then on, it was the trade unions singing Frère Jacques at every possible opportunity. And Mrs. Thatcher, of course, famously said that she wasn't getting rid of trade unionism out the front door and having it come in by the back door. And then the trade union movement sort of flipped over to being pro-European. I mean, is that a fair caricature?
I think that's absolutely fair. But up to the point when Jacques Delors addressed the TUC Congress, what was a reality is that the social change and the protection about working time, the social chapter, all the progressive development of trade unions, for trade unions during that period, emanates out of Europe. And Europe became our travel to work area, our recruiting area. And as the multinationals grew and spread, it became very much a collective bargaining area as well, because a lot of British-based companies have European subsidiaries, and we were bargaining in that sphere. So I think trade unions recognized that with a government at home that had an agenda to regulate trade unions in a totally different way, because the government had an agenda which was driven politically as well as economically. The government, some of the laws that the government brought in, for example, laws like the fact that if you want to have a political fund, you have to have a ballot, and the government hoped that trade unions would say no to a ballot, so they wouldn't have a political fund. That means they couldn't engage in political activity, they couldn't affiliate to political parties. So you'd get two for the price of one. You would undermine the political party as their opponents, but you would also emasculate the strength of the trade unions. So the trade unions was in that position. And suddenly they saw that the only way we were going to have social, economic progress and workplace protection was through the gateways of Europe. And any doubts that we had was dispelled by the Jacques Delors speech, putting forward a totally new agenda for Europe. And we embrace that. But looking back, I don't think that we have maximized our opportunities that Europe could have provided. I suspect it's not so much the trade union's fault in that respect, because I think the way that the government, successive governments, has actually handled the European debate, history will show that's one of the period of the greatest missed opportunities in many ways. We are in a situation where Europe is a reality, it is expanding, it is where we travel to work, it is where we negotiate, it is where we recruit. Our contracts has got to be advertised on a pan-European basis as a result of that. And because of the failure of government to embrace the European dimension in a very positive way and seek to democratize Europe, we get into a situation where there is still a lot of suspicion around about Britain's place in Europe. And, you know, when I contemplate the European dimension of political debate, I recall this missed opportunity. And I remember when Clinton stood for the presidency of the United States first time around, there was a sort of focused message in his campaign headquarters: it's the economy, stupid. Well, if we were to send one clear political message, then it would be Europe, stupid, because we haven't maximized the opportunities that might have been there. Purely on the basis that on much of the issues, the government hasn't embraced the political dimension. It's like the single currency. The government tried to promote the single currency as purely an economic issue. Well, clearly it's not. It's the biggest. Giving up your currency is probably the biggest political decision any country could ever be asked to take. And you can't have economic conversions without a degree of political conversion. If that simple message had been put across, that the whole thing can be managed, that we can have a democratized Europe, a Europe which is sensitive to the people, a Europe which understands that in a democracy, the legislature controls the executive, but the way the European map is drawn now is the executive is controlling the legislature. Yeah, so we need to deal with some of the institutions of Europe and put them within the democratic path, and then we begin to see the expansion and the benefits of Europe. So there are many, many big questions there, but it is the single biggest question that this generation has to face, and the politicians are not facing it.
But I thought that you had spoken out against the single currency.
I spoke out against the single currency within the context of no safeguards, no provision. And for the TNG and me in particular, it's never been a question of if we join the single currency. It's going to be about when we join the single currency. But I've argued very strongly that, you have to have democratization of a lot of the institution. The Growth and Stability Pact, which you've seen what's happened to it, our position has always been that you have to ensure that there's a tremendous amount that converges before you take a step for the Growth and Stability Pact, as whatever it is. So it was the conditions has had to be right. We weren't converged, as you know, but the government has not sought to manage the debate. All that they sought to do is to say, well, it's good for the economy, without saying what are you going to do with the politics.
Well, I'm sure that's fair enough. But now I'll open it up to the audience in a minute, but let me just take you on to one other topic before I do so, and that is the new task that you have taken on. Many people would think that taking on the Transport and General Workers Union was enough of a a burden to take on for one lifetime, but now the Metropolitan Police. And I don't know, however, that I totally understand quite what you've been asked to do, because the way it was presented in the media when you were doing it is that you were dealing with racism in the Metropolitan Police, but actually the terms of reference seem to talk about employment practices. Absolutely. What is it you've been asked to do? What's the problem you're trying to solve?
Well, let me say first of all that we've had the debate in terms of community policing. We had this Carmen report. We've had the debate in terms of how the Metropolitan Police responded. We had the McPherson debate. The inquiry that I lead has got absolutely nothing to do with any of those two issues. It's to inquire into professional standards on workplace issues. That's the terms of reference, and that's what myself and my colleagues are seeking to do. Of course, there's been one or two high-profile cases recently, and those two cases naturally have a workplace dimension that we need to look at. What we're trying to do is to see whether or not, in today's world, in a changing world, whether the remit of the Metropolitan Police, in terms of how it functions, in terms of how it conducts its business, is consistent with the needs of the 21st century. The Metropolitan Police, in terms of its task, has got a very difficult task. It's policing a community which is changing. It's a different London than the one which we knew 10, 15, 20 years ago. The boundaries of detection and prevention of crime is in fact increasing. One of the debates, for example, that has emerged in recent time, apart from global terrorism, is issues like whether we should have Sky Marshal and aeroplanes to take it at its bare minimum. And therefore, how they were able to respond from a managerial perspective, say 20 years ago, they have to respond differently. They have different areas of political accountability. Until the year 2000, the political accountability for the Metropolitan Police was the Home Secretary. Since then, they've added the GLA, they've added the Metropolitan Police Authority, the MPA, they've added the Office of the Mayor, and of course the boroughs, 32 boroughs. So we've got five political centres of political authority at the moment, or accountability. So you can begin to see the change in terms of governance, in terms of management, in terms of operational issue, and looking at a multiracial, multicultural workforce and a community which is demanding more and more. And they've had one or two high-profile failures, I think they'd be the first to. So we're looking at the professional standards and we're looking at the workplace practices, and we're saying to Londoners, if you want your police force to be responsive, come and talk to us and tell us what it is you want. Because I said publicly, and I say again, we don't just want to hear what's wrong. We want to hear what's right, but equally importantly, we want people to tell us what changes they think are necessary to have a police force which is responsive and maintain the ethos of policing by consent. So that's what we're trying to do here.
And your report is to whom? To the authority? Which are these five people?
Yes, it's a good question. We put in a raffle and said, who wants it? No, we've been commissioned by the MPA, the Metropolitan Police Authority, and that's the body to which we'll deliver our report when it's completed.
And that by agreement with the Commissioner?
Oh yes, no, the Commissioner is giving full support. And some of the issues that arise is that they are Crown servants. Police officers are Crown servants. The officer constable was established on the Peel in 1824, whenever it was. So they don't enjoy the protection of a contract of employment like most of us do, apart from one or two recent development around discrimination cases. They can't march into a tribunal and claim unfair dismissal. So you can begin to see some of the issues that we have to have a look at. So the Commissioner is supporting. He said publicly that he thinks a lot of the practices which governs their employment relationship ought to be scrapped, and he wish he had a clean sheet of paper to start again. So you can begin to see the scale of the task. We've got support by the Commissioner and, of course, the Home Secretary.
And how many years is this going to take you?
I hope less than one.
And even time to go to the cricket tour.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Nothing interferes with me on my cricket.
Let me open it up to the audience at this point. We've got a couple of microphones floating around. Who'd like to start off? Yeah, down the front. Thanks.
I'm Margaret Thomas, and I'm a graduate of the school of 1956, retired in 2001. Now, I've been here this week. We've had a very good series of lectures by Professor Acemoglu of the Massachusetts Institution of Technology on institutions in civil society and the importance of those institutions in relation to civil rights. What worries me greatly in all the time I've been in this struggle for women and women's position, now we are still seeing women averaging about 80% of men's wages. And then today, we heard this whole debate about pregnancy and the fact that employers, and particularly small employers, very often want to get rid of the women then. If the women declare that they're pregnant, they've got no security of employment. Now, what is puzzling me is individuals are very weak in society. What sort of framework do you think women can go forward in? I mean, what does the trade union offer to women now in relation to part-time working, flexible working, gaps for pregnancy, gaps for caring for their elderly relatives, and so on? What's on offer?
Yes. Well, first of all, let's say that dismissal for reasons of pregnancy is unfair. That is the legal position. Nobody should be dismissed because they're pregnant, and the law protects that position. But the trade union has, in terms of the trade union agenda, around non-discriminatory issues, has got, in my view, a fairly good record. And it's not just about committees. It's about ensuring that women in trade unions develop agendas, get access to participation, and make sure that the structures within trade union involve women. And more importantly, to put some of these issues that you've talked about onto the collective bargaining agenda. 80%, you know, women's wage is about 82%, which clearly is not good enough. If people are doing the job, then you're entitled to the proper pay. But what has actually happened over the years, you know, on issues about working, proper time off, issues around pay, all the issues which helps family life, when trade unions put together their claims, it's the issues which affects women most are the ones that are conceded when the negotiations start. Because the way most of the negotiating committees are made up, the women are not there to fight, to argue that no, we can't have those sort of concessions. So there's a tremendous need for women to be involved, to participate, and to be involved. But the trade union movement has got to make sure that it creates the conditions. You can't sort of just run your trade union on the basis that the meetings are in some inaccessible place on a Sunday morning, because, you know, not, it's bad for men, never mind women, and all those are issues. But more and more women are taking responsibility in the trade union movement, in the TUC, and we've got to give encouragement. And the women have to make the demands. They have to make demands. They have to develop their confidence. They must have an independent and articulate voice, not as a separate, but when they develop the policy needs, those policies have got to come back within the mainstream. But the TUC's got, in my judgment anyway, a fairly good record in terms of articulating, fighting for, and promoting issues around women. Building on the legislation, we've got the commission, Equal Rights Commission. We got lots of legislation, but we have to let those legislation work, and women have to make demands on the system.
But to the one third row there, thanks.
Can I just continue from that and ask you, why is it being too naive and or idealistic to say, well, why do the women actually have to be there before their concerns can be properly taken into account? Why isn't it that trade union men aren't just as easily able to see what's fair for women and make sure they get it?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. It should be like that. But it's not happening, is it? Because if it was happening, we wouldn't have the pay gap as we have. If you look at some of the pay structures, you'll see 5-6 grades, for example, for the same jobs. And you'll find the women almost inevitably are at the lower grades. And there is inbuilt discrimination in terms of the structure. Now, I just happen to believe that after all the campaigning, after all the legislation, after all that, the best way, I just believe that the victims of discrimination are the best advocate for change. And the real issue is to ensure that there are structures. If you have a workforce which is equal or whatever the percentage is, and you construct your negotiating committee and you construct your bargaining agenda without addressing the balance, then it seems to me that you are saying to a proportion, we will speak for you. And I think that the only way you're going to get true equality is to empower the victims of discrimination to speak for themselves. I argue very strongly for women.
An idea I've thought about the trade unions for whatever, 30, 35, 40 years, is perhaps in this point that it's too much a let's get what we can regardless of what's reasonable or fair. Now, I know that used to happen, you know, for a long time it hasn't, in any way they've declined. It just seemed a shame, really, for the movement that started to help those who really needed it somewhat ended up helping those with the most power, whether it's the men or those who happen to work in a large organisation like a car factory, and the rest, everybody could just, well, it's too bad, let them, you know, claw their own way up, we're not interested. It just felt a lot like that, and especially as a woman who wasn't working when I was bringing up my children or only part-time or whatever, the trade unions didn't seem to care less for the rest of society, just only for themselves, and that seemed a shame, and probably still does, if it still happens. Well, it does a bit, as we've just said, with the women.
Yeah, the ideals are there. I don't think the ideals are not lost, but you have to measure the practice and the outcomes as well. And you have to ask, how on earth did we get here? It's the negotiators. If the current negotiators and the bargaining agenda has not delivered equality, then it seems to me that you have to seek to effect some modicum of change. You can't sort of just leave it to the good intention of the people who have failed you. You have to challenge the system. And I think the best way of challenging the system is to get involved, join, participate, and change.
Next. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, you'll please excuse me if you find this question not related to you, but I just thought that we should bring in the plight of the workers in the third world as well and just ask you about your opinion, because just like England and the North is losing its jobs, much of the jobs are being transferred to the developing world. I'm from Pakistan, and so the kind of scenario we see developing over there is, of course, one, a lot of these low-rung jobs are being transferred there, but what's happening is that a lot of informalization of work is also happening. And in addition to the regular informal economy that we have, a lot of the formal work sector is also becoming informalized. And so with that, the question of workers' rights arises, and we see the workers' rights movement weakening as the globalization movement carries on. And I was just wondering what you see in the future for workers' rights in such a scenario coming up?
Well, workers' rights, there are forums like the ILO, the National Labour Organization, there are International Trade Secretariat, and many, many forums nationally and internationally that work to protect workers in the workplace. And there are national laws and international laws. And of course, there is a strength of workers in terms of collective bargaining, which is an area. I think that you have a situation where capital is flexible, it's global, it travels, it moves. To a lesser degree, so is labour. You have to measure it on the basis of investment going out, but investment coming in as well. It's not exclusively a one-way traffic. And therefore, you have to build degrees of solidarity where you can. There's no one single answer. One of the things that isn't open to us, there is no option which says, you know, stop the world, we want to get off. We can't do that. You have to humanize the process as much as you can. You have to bargain. And you have to ensure that you get as much protection as you can. But if you take the whole question of the call centers, a lot of institutions, particularly in the banking industry, Howard has just come from the FSA, knows exactly much of what's happening. Jobs are going on the basis of new areas of activity in the Far East, India and Pakistan, for example, India in particular. A lot of jobs are going, but equally a lot of jobs are coming here as well from those places. So when you know the trade unions argue the case that the jobs ought to remain here, whilst that's understandable for the people who are being displaced, and frankly there aren't many people displaced. If everyone took this, the view that there should be no exchanges, well, you know, the world would sort of get to a point where there is no development, and I don't think anybody wants that to happen. So I think it's got to be certain basic ground rules about how you protect the people, how you transfer the skills, how you develop new skills, and how you create new opportunities as can be created. We still have a tremendous shortage of skills.
Can I just press you on the centre of that, because you mentioned the ILO. And when I was at the CBI for 3 years, I was one of the delegates to the ILO, because the ILO is trilateral, tripartite, sorry. You have government, employers, and trade unions. And I have to say, when I went to those sessions in Geneva, I thought I'd died. I mean, it's in a time warp, the ILO. And, you know, things happen at an unbelievably glacial pace. Doesn't that need to be improved and brought so that it is a more responsive organization to these changes?
You use the correct word. It's not the most responsive organization in the world. You're absolutely right. But it's got no power as itself. It's like any collective institution. It's only as strong as the power given to it by its constituent part. And the ILO will only work like the United Nations. It's the industrial arm of the United UN itself. And you can see the global paralysis in the UN when the big questions come up. So to expect the ILO to be more vigorous and innovative and more responsive than the UN itself is probably asking more than it can deliver.
Well, it makes the UN look like Microsoft. One question down the front.
Thank you, Director, for sharing your dialogue with us as well. Sir Bill Morris, I'm pleased to know that by next year, the Metropolitan Police workforce will truly reflect the community with which the issue is about personal favors. I mean, wine, women, or maybe scholarships, there are rumors that you are going to become a governor general of your own country, Jamaica. So as a trade unionist, because the British establishment notorious for buying people like, I mean, the leaders, to buy their silence. So do you have any experience, and what advice you will offer for us? maybe future. You said that we want to be a trade unionist in the future, at least some of us. Number two is that along with the feminism in the trade union, racism. See, I was a member of British Medical Association, the greatest. I was thrown out of there physically. And then by a phone call, they cancelled my membership. I got one another union, defense union. They said, we don't have member because the consultant who sacked me is their member. So there is so much racism because I'm talking about NHS. So 1/3 of workforce is from this government poaches workforce. So you are asking us to activate, to participate, but it's we are physically thrown out. So I will call the commissioner. So wow, why? See, this is very difficult because we all have faith. People like you, if I am suffering in this century, I mean, what things happened to you in the last year? So how to get these things done then?
Yeah.
You're going to be governor of Jamaica, Bill?
There's no vacancy. I happen to know the Governor General pretty well. There's no vacancy and there's no office, so there you are. But, we can't judge an organization or an institution on the basis of one or two bad experiences.
There are reports and NHS is also, but I don't have to raise a person. Sure. Recently, somebody died.
No.
It's someone, Jamaica.
Yes.
I'm not saying that I'm a great man.
No.
I'm not saying that I'm a criminal. Yes. Sure. This is what they get.
No.
I'm talking about Richard.
No. Every organization has got certain values. It stands for certain things. It's got its own culture. It sets out to fulfill its mission as it sees it. So I don't think we can judge a trade union movement or indeed any institution on one or two examples, unfortunate as those are. Fact of the matter is that the trade union movement are no different. The trade union movement is a microcosm of British society. We know better, we know worse. And it's the individuals within those institutions that can make a difference. And that's why it is important when I talk about participation and involvement and seek to effect change. That is the only route open because it seems to me that you either settle for the status quo or you seek to change. And for me, the Progressive Party is to seek to change. And the best way of changing is in fact is through involvement. It won't change if you stand outside and says what an awful thing. Okay, you might get a headline tomorrow, but things remain the same.
A number of people have caught my eye. First, next one over here.
My question relates to the relationship trade union movement has with the Labour government.
Yeah.
Because this relationship, they are not precisely friendly. And sometimes even your union took industrial actions in strong adversarial fashion against the government. Yet what puzzles me is the fact that if you look at statistics, from 98 onwards are the best years with regards union membership since the 70s. And the income distribution in England, well, in Great Britain, compares favorably with previous periods and also with other European countries in similar periods with regards to wage earners. Actually, wage share of GDP increased in Great Britain while it was decreasing in the rest of Europe. So my impression is that there's something missing in order to find a global agreement between the trade union movement and Labour government so that you can get fair wage increases and also competitive wage increases at the same time. Why this is not possible? Why the government and the trade unions can find a positive win-win deal?
Well, first of all, the government is an employer as well. It's responsible for a significant proportion of the people in employment, and it has that responsibility to look after the people that it employs. The relationship between trade unions and government isn't a relationship about money, about pay, because you have to separate out that from the political relationship against the employment relationship. They're totally separate and different consideration. You talk about the comparisons in terms of the rest of Europe, for example. We are very fortunate because we happen to have not caught the recessions of recent times that has affected other economies. Ours have managed to expand, perhaps slowly, our growth rate. has been about 2.5% to 2.5%, thereabout. And therefore, trade unions has been in a relatively, better position, relatively, relative to other areas in Europe, to increase pay and to increase living standards. But I think it's absolutely key and essential that we do not confuse the relationship in terms of the government as an employer and the political party which forms the government, in this instance the Labour Party, because they are two separate and distinct relationships and they shouldn't be confused at all.
We have one here. Thanks.
When you spoke about the journey into Europe from British trade unions have made, it sounded quite opportunistic in the sense that you kind of said it was like a reaction to the Thatcherite domestic exclusion.
Mm.
Now you have a sympathetic or a more sympathetic government. Does that make Europe less important than it did throughout the 80s?
No. It makes it more important because Europe presents the big opportunity. And my regret, and is the regret of a lot of people, is the government is not grasping the nettle, not dealing with the issues to maximise the opportunities that are there. If you take the arguments and the current debate at the moment, I for one believe that we should have some sort of framework. So I'm not anti the European Constitution, for example. I think it's right and proper that we should have some framework. I might argue the case about this elected presidents and all that sort of stuff. But having a framework by which we develop, by which we grow, that's fine. I can't understand why that ought not to be put to the British people. I cannot understand it. I support a European constitution, but I want the British people to have the last say. You know, the government says, trust me. Well, I trust the British people. I trust democracy. So I'm just giving that an example where I think the ideals are right, the intention are good, but the execution and the methodology is destroying the ideals and the good intention. That's my concern. And exactly the same thing with the single currency. And Europe, in terms of its expansion and its development, is unstoppable. We are going to add another, 70 million people to the 360 million there or thereabout. Huge opportunity. Okay, for the first 10 years it will be an investment until their economies are modernized and grow and develop and their disposable income, whatever. There is no threat there. It's all opportunities. But the debate that we've had, we've given assurances and, in responding to the Daily Mail and the Daily Express, we're seeking to roll back on those assurances. So we know further forward in embracing the continent on which we are a part than we were probably 10, 15 years ago. The debate is going backwards because there's no, sort of committed vision. I think the Prime Minister is totally committed. I think the government, but if you are committed, then you have to not take risks as such, but you have to pursue your commitment with a degree of conviction. And we see no conviction at all coming forward. And we are losing big, big, big opportunities.
I wanted to ask whether you thought that political correctness was actually a hindrance to equality. Given that I actually believe that we've got into a world now where you're not actually allowed to say...
I'm not hearing you very well. I'm sorry.
Political correctness
a
handicap, an obstacle to equality.
Yeah, an obstacle to equality. Because I happen to believe that we've moved into a world now where we've got kind of issues that need to be discussed and brought out into the open, but people won't discuss them and they're not brought out into the open because people are scared to say the wrong thing. And I think in the long run that will harm all minority groups.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the so-called, what is political correctness? I've never really sort of comprehend any proper understanding of this so-called term political correctness. If by political correctness you mean, it means that you recognize people's diversity, their difference, their sensitivity or whatever it is, then, I don't sort of share the view that that's politically correct. There is a correct way. It's about behavior we should be talking about political behavior rather than political correctness in that sense. But we are, you know, we live in a society where opinions are easily formed, and you have a situation where when politicians make decision, it's driven by what's the headline in the Sun going to be tomorrow, or what's the headline in the Mail going to be tomorrow. And what we need is a little bit of conviction politics, and we would get away from the so-called political correctness. Because all these issues, they are issues around equality, there are issues around opportunity, there are issues around people's dignities, people's rights. They're all the same issues in one way or another. But there are, as I've said, there is a lack of political conviction because the politicians have got their eyes on the next headline, the next edition coming out. And I think it's causing a lot of damage to the country. And it means that we're not really punching our full weight because we keep looking over our shoulder, you know, and it's being expressed as political correctness. It's just a distraction, quite honestly.
Now, we're running up against our deadline, but I think I've got a couple of people, one at the back and then one in the middle. I'll take these two questions. Thanks.
So, my name's Ian Begg. Bill, you are known, I think, probably not unfairly, as a brownie.
As
a brownie in Labour Party terms.
A brownie. Oh,
a
brownie. That's
hard. Gordon Brown. You know that guy? Yeah.
This is not.
He's retired, you know. He's forgotten.
It's not a racist remark. leaving aside the question of Europe, if you could wave your magic wand and get the Labour Party to do two or three things that are different from what they're doing now, what would they be?
Yes. The two or three things. I happen to believe that the key issues on which the Labour government will be judged is the public services. Because they're right at the very heart of the everyday lives of the overwhelming majority of the nation. And I think that concentrating on rebuilding the public services from the perspective of not just throwing money at it, as it's been suggested, but public services in health, transport, education, all those are the issues on which people, as I go around the country and talk to people and talk to TNG members, and I'm a user of those, I'm a consumer now of some of those services. When I go home at night and complain about public transport, I'm told, well, now you know what ordinary people had to cope with, you know. So, for me, public services would be key. Europe would be important, and taking the perspective of tackling issues around global poverty. If you look at the pandemic which is threatening to wipe out Africa in terms of HIV/AIDS, the mind boggles that we can be so complacent and not seeing that we need to do much more. 0.7% of GDP as our contribution is not good enough in today's world, not good enough at all. So those are the three things that I would want. Then fix public service, take a constructive, engaged attitude to Europe, and tackle world poverty. And when you tackle world poverty, you won't resolve it overnight, but I see it as an investment. I really do see the agenda to tackle world poverty as an investment, because you're uplifting people up, and if you make that sort of investment, then they will either buy your technology or they will send you some more doctors, as we are now recruiting all over the world, or some more scientists or whatever it is, because We find it easy now to go all over the world now and recruit doctors and teachers, and we even get in Sierra Leone now to progress our immigration. You know, the white man burden is being sent back to Africa and all those things. And it's just sort of undermining a lot of commitment and stopping us going forward in a real and positive way. But those would not be my three things that I want the Labour government to do.
I think that's only two-thirds of a brownie, isn't it? Probably. We'll take one last question right in the middle here.
Sorry, it was mentioned before that in order to conduct change, the discriminated parties, their voices were going to have to be heard, and they were going to have to take a greater participation. Referring back to lesser developed countries, if employees are less able to speak out because of the problems to do with their voices being heard, if there's a problem with that, then businesses are so able, being footloose, to move elsewhere. What hope there is there for their rights to be heard and to be constructed so that we make sure they are fairly treated?
Yeah, well, we're very fortunate in Britain in terms of the degree of legislation we have to protect people at work. I think we've got some good legislation. I think we can obviously build, if you take the whole raft of equalities legislation, you know, we've got sex discrimination, we've got race, we've got disability, right across the board. So there's a lot of protective legislation, and rightly so. I think that's right. And that's why I try and make the argument to say, when you build a real ring of protection, there's only so much that the government can do. There's only so much that society can do. It's about individuals and how do you build degrees of alliance in order that you can make a contribution to not just the debate but doing things in a very positive way. So I'm quite heartened in a way. I've still got a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of hope, very clear in my thoughts about how things can in fact be changed. But you will only get the change when citizens and communities decide that they are going to be involved and make their contribution. You know, for much of the issues we keep looking at others rather than or them or that institution, without recognizing that even writing a letter to the local paper makes a contribution, because you're actually raising some of these issues. So I can't see a better alternative, quite honestly, of making change, and then the citizens continue to agitate, continue to articulate the demands, and continue to be part of the push and the movement which brings change. That's how we got where we are now. And if we are to abandon that sort of degree of involvement and participation, then we are basically saying that we've arrived and there's no further to go. And I don't think we've arrived at all. I think there's a lot further that we can go, but it does mean commitment of ourselves.
Bill, thank you very much. Thank you for answering the questions so frankly and so fully. We wish you the best of luck with the Jamaican University of Technology.
Thank you.
I should have mentioned also your role, United World Colleges, where we take a lot of students, actually.
Okay.
We are very pleased with the ones we receive.
Yeah, that's good.
We wish you even more luck with the inquiry into the Metropolitan Police, which is a matter of close interest to all of us.
Thank you.
And speaking personally, I wish you no luck at all.
In the cricket.
In the cricket. Thank you.
Thank you very much.